having become the most illustrious and most beloved of God of all kings, and surpassing in understanding and in wealth all those before him who had held rule over the Hebrews, he did not persevere in these things to the end, but abandoning the observance of his ancestral customs, he did not end his life in a manner like what we have described of him, but became mad for women and given to unrestrained lust, and was not content with women of his own nation, but married many from foreign peoples as well, Sidonians, Tyrians, Ammonites, and Idumeans, transgressing thereby the laws of Moses, which forbade marrying women not of the same stock. And he began to worship the gods of those women, indulging them and his own passion for them, though the lawgiver had foreseen this very thing and had forbidden marrying women of other lands, lest, entangled with foreign customs, the people should abandon their ancestral ways and come to honor those women's gods, neglecting to honor their own. But of these things Solomon took no heed, carried away by senseless pleasure, for having taken wives who were daughters of rulers and men of distinction, 700 in number and 300 concubines. And besides these, the daughter of the king of the Egyptians, he was at once so mastered by them that he came to imitate their ways, and was compelled, out of good will and affection, to give them proof by living as was ancestral to them. And as his years advanced, and his reasoning grew weaker with time in resisting the pull of memory toward the customs of his homeland's women, he came all the more to neglect his own God, and persisted in honoring the gods introduced through these marriages. Even before this, he had chanced to sin and to fail in the keeping of the laws, when he had the bronze images of oxen made for the base beneath the sea he had dedicated, and the lions about his own throne, for it was not lawful to make these either. Though he had the finest and most fitting example of virtue in his own father, and the glory his father had left behind through his piety toward God, he did not imitate him, even though God had appeared to him twice in his sleep and had urged him to imitate his father, and so he died without honor. At once, then, the prophet came, sent by God, saying that his transgressions had not gone unnoticed, and warning that he would not long rejoice in what he had done. Yet the kingdom would not be taken from him while he lived, since God had promised his father David to make Solomon's line his successor. But when Solomon died, God would deal thus with his son, not turning the whole people away from him, but giving 10 tribes to his servant, and leaving only 2 to David's grandson, for the sake of David himself, because he had loved God, and for the sake of the city of Jerusalem, in which God had wished to have his temple. Hearing this, Solomon was grieved and thrown into great confusion, since nearly all the good things for which he had been envied were now turning toward a wretched change. Not long after the prophet had announced to him what was to come, God raised up against him an enemy named Hadad, whose hostility had its origin as follows. He was a boy of Idumean race, of royal stock. When Joab, David's general, subdued Idumea and destroyed all who were of age to bear arms over the course of 6 months, Hadad fled and came to Pharaoh, king of the Egyptians, who received him kindly, gave him a house and land for his support, and when he came of age, loved him so much that he even gave him his own wife's sister, named Toppines, in marriage, and the son born of her was raised together with the king's own children. Hearing then of David's death in Egypt and of Joab's death, he approached Pharaoh and asked leave to go to his own country. When the king asked what he lacked, or what had befallen him, that he was eager to leave him, though he pressed and pleaded often, he was not released at that time. But at the very time when Solomon's affairs had already begun to go badly, because of the transgressions we have described and God's anger over them, Pharaoh consented, and Hadad went to Idumea, unable to bring it to revolt from Solomon, for it was held by many garrisons and had no freedom or safe opportunity for rebellion because of them, he set out from there and came into Syria. There he fell in with a certain Rhazes, who had fled from his master Hadadezer, king of Sophene, and was living as a bandit in that country. Joining himself to him in friendship with the band of brigands Rhazes had about him, Hadad marched up, seized that part of Syria and was proclaimed its king, and while Solomon still lived, he raided and plundered the land of the Israelites, harrying it. Such were the sufferings the Hebrews endured at the hands of Hadad. Jeroboam, son of Nebat, one of Solomon's own countrymen, also rose up against him, in accordance with a prophecy made to him long before, to the effect that he had hoped for great things from him, For when Solomon saw that this boy, whom his father had left behind and whose mother had raised him, was noble and daring in spirit, he put him in charge of the building of the walls when he threw the circuit around Jerusalem. Jeroboam took such care over the work that the king was pleased with him and gave him, as a reward, command over the tribe of Joseph. As Jeroboam was leaving Jerusalem at that time, he met a prophet from the city of Shiloh named Ahijah, who greeted him and led him off the road a little way into an open field where no one else was present. There he tore the cloak he was wearing into 12 pieces and told Jeroboam to take 10 of them, saying, "This is what God wills. He is tearing Solomon's kingdom in two. To his son he gives one tribe, and the one adjoining it, because of the promise made to David, but to you he gives the 10, since Solomon has sinned against him and given himself over to foreign women and their gods. Know then the reason why God is turning his purpose away from Solomon, and try to be just and keep the laws, since the greatest of all prizes lies before you, the reward of piety and honor toward God, and you will become as great as you know David became." Elated by the prophet's words, Jeroboam, who was by nature a hot-headed young man and eager for great things, could not stay still. Once he had taken up his command, remembering what Ahijah had revealed to him, he set at once about persuading the people to revolt from Solomon and to turn and bring the leadership over to himself. But Solomon learned of his intention and his design and sought to seize and kill him. Jeroboam, learning of this before it happened, fled to Isochus, king of the Egyptians, and remained there until Solomon's death, thereby both escaping harm at Solomon's hands and preserving himself for the kingship. Solomon died at an advanced age, having reigned 80 years and lived 94. He was buried in Jerusalem, having surpassed in prosperity, wealth, and wisdom all the kings who reigned before him, except for the wrongs into which he was led in his old age, deceived by his wives, matters concerning which, and the evils that befell the Hebrews on their account, we shall find a more fitting occasion to explain. After Solomon's death, his son Rehoboam succeeded to the kingdom. His mother was an Ammonite woman named Naama. The leaders of the people at once sent to Egypt and summoned Jeroboam. When he came to them at the city of Shechem, Rehoboam too went there, for it had been decided that he should be proclaimed king there when the Israelites had gathered together. So the leaders of the people and Jeroboam approached him and asked him to relax somewhat the burden of servitude that lay on them and to be gentler than his father had been. For they had borne a heavy yoke under him, and said that they would be better disposed toward Rehoboam and would embrace their servitude out of good will rather than fear, if he showed them kindness. He told them he would give his answer about their request after 3 days, and this at once made him suspect, since he did not immediately grant them what would please them, for they thought that kindness and generosity ought to come readily, especially from one so young, yet it still seemed that deliberating, rather than refusing outright, held out some good hope. He called together his father's friends and took counsel with them as to what answer he should give the people. They, as was to be expected of men well disposed and acquainted with the nature of crowds, advised him to deal kindly with the people and speak to them in a more democratic manner than befits the majesty of kingship. For in this way he would win their goodwill, since subjects by nature love gentleness and being treated as nearly equal to their kings. But he turned away from counsel that was so good and, perhaps, advantageous for the whole future, or, if not for the whole, at least for that moment when he needed to become king. Because, I suppose, God had already decreed that what was truly to his advantage should be rejected by him. He called together the young men who had been raised with him, told them of the older men's advice, and asked them to say what they thought he should do. They, since neither their youth nor God allowed them to perceive the better course, urged him to answer the people, that his little finger was thicker than his father's loins, and that if they had found his father harsh, they would find him far more difficult still, and that if his father had disciplined them with whips, they should expect him to do it with scorpions. Pleased with this answer and thinking it befitted the dignity of his office, when the assembled people came to hear it on the third day, while the whole people stood expectant and eager to hear something from the king, supposing it would be something kind, he set aside the young men's counsel and gave them the answer of his friends. This was done in accordance with God's will, so that what Ahijah had prophesied might come to pass. Stung and pained by his words as though they had been put to the test, the people grew angry and, crying out altogether, declared that from that day on they had no part, nor any kinship, with David and his line, and that they would leave to Rehoboam only the temple which his grandfather had built. So bitterly did they feel, and so long did they nurse their anger, that when he sent Adoram, the man in charge of the tribute, to soothe them and win over those among them who had spoken rashly and roughly. To make them gentler, they would not tolerate it, but stoned him to death. When Rehoboam saw this, and thought that he himself had been struck by the very stones with which the crowd had killed his servant, fearing that he might actually suffer this fate in reality, he mounted his chariot at once and fled to Jerusalem. The tribe of Judah and the tribe of Benjamin made him king, but the rest of the people, from that day forward, deserted the sons of David and made Jeroboam master of affairs. Rehoboam, Solomon's son, called an assembly of the two tribes still subject to him, and was prepared to take from them 180,000 picked troops and march out against Jeroboam and the people to force them by war into servitude to him. But he was prevented by God, through the prophet, from making this campaign. The prophet said it was not right for kinsmen to make war on one another, especially since the people's revolt had come about by God's own choice, and so Rehoboam did not go out. I shall first relate what Jeroboam, king of the Israelites, did, and then, following on from this, set forth what was done by Rehoboam, king of the two tribes. For in this way, I think, the good order of the narrative will be preserved throughout. Jeroboam then built a palace in the city of Shechem and made his residence there, and he also built one in the city called Penuel. Not long afterward, as the Feast of Tabernacles was approaching, he reasoned that if he allowed the people to go up to Jerusalem to worship God and to spend the festival there, they might well repent and, lured back by the temple and the worship offered in it to God, abandon him and go over to the first king. And that if this happened, he would be in danger of losing his life. So he devised the following scheme. He made two golden calves and built two small shrines for them, one in the city of Bethel and the other in Dan, which lies near the springs of the Lesser Jordan. He set the calves in each of the shrines in these cities, and, summoning the 10 tribes over which he ruled, he addressed them in these words. Fellow tribesmen, I think you know this, that every place has God in it, and there is no single appointed place in which he is present, but he hears everywhere and watches over those who worship him. For this reason, it does not seem to me necessary for you now to hurry off to Jerusalem, the city of your enemies, to worship there by so long a journey. For it was a man who built that temple, and I too have made two golden calves, consecrated to God, and I have dedicated one in the city of Bethel and the other in Dan, so that those of you who live nearest to these cities may go there and worship God. And I will appoint for you priests and Levites from among your own number, so that you have no need of the tribe of Levi or the sons of Aaron. Rather, whoever among you wishes to be a priest, let him offer to God a bull and a ram, just as they say Aaron, the first priest, also did. By saying this, he deceived the people and led them, once they had abandoned their ancestral worship, to transgress the laws. This became the beginning of evils for the Hebrews, and the cause of their being defeated in war by foreigners and falling into captivity. But these matters we shall set forth in their proper place. When the feast came, in the seventh month, Jeroboam himself wished to celebrate it at Bethel, just as the two tribes were celebrating it in Jerusalem, and he built an altar in front of the calf. And, having made himself high priest, he went up to the altar together with his own priests. But as he was about to offer the sacrifices and the whole burnt offerings in the sight of all the people, a prophet named Jadon came to him from Jerusalem, sent by God, and, standing in the midst of the crowd where the king could hear him, spoke these words, directed at the altar. God foretells that there will come, of David's line, one named Josiah, who will sacrifice upon you the false priests who will arise at that time, and will burn upon you the bones of these deceivers of the people, these frauds and impious men. And so that they may believe this will indeed happen, I will foretell for them a sign that will come to pass. This altar will split apart at once, and all the fat of the sacrificial animals upon it will be poured out on the ground. When the prophet said this, Jeroboam, enraged, stretched out his hand and ordered him seized. But the outstretched hand was at once paralyzed, and he could no longer draw it back to himself, but held it hanging there, numb and dead. The altar too split apart, and everything on it was cast down, just as the prophet had foretold. Recognizing that the man spoke the truth and possessed divine foreknowledge, Jeroboam begged him to entreat God to restore life to his right hand. The prophet prayed to God to grant him this, and when the king's hand recovered its natural use, he rejoiced and invited the prophet to dine with him. But Jadon said he would not consent to enter his house, nor to taste bread or water in that city, for God had forbidden him this, and had also told him not to return by the road he had come, but by another. The king marveled at his self-restraint, but he himself remained fearful, suspecting from what had been said that some evil change in his own affairs was coming. Now there was in the city an old man, a wicked false prophet, whom Jeroboam held in honor, being deceived by him, since the man said what pleased him. This man was at that time confined to bed by the weakness of old age. But when his sons told him about the prophet who had just come from Jerusalem, and about the signs that had occurred, and how Jeroboam's right hand had been paralyzed and had been restored to life again at the man's prayer, he grew afraid that the stranger might be held in higher esteem than himself by the king and enjoy greater honor. And so he ordered his sons at once to saddle the donkey and prepare it for him to set out. When they had hastened to do as they were told, he mounted and pursued the prophet. And catching up with him resting under a leafy tree that had the shade of a large oak, he greeted him first, then reproached him for not having come to his house and partaken of his hospitality. When Jadon replied that he had been forbidden by God to taste food at anyone's house in that city, the old man said, "But not altogether at mine. God has not forbidden you my table, for I too am a prophet, and share the same worship of him as you, and I am here now, sent by him, to bring you to my own house to dine." Jadon, believing his lie, turned back with him. But while they were still at the meal, enjoying each other's company, God appeared to Jadon and told him that he would pay the penalty for transgressing his commands, and declared what it would be. He said a lion would meet him on the road as he went away, and that he would be destroyed by it, and would be deprived of burial in his ancestral tombs. This happened, I suppose, by God's will, so that Jeroboam should not heed the words of Jadon, once he had been proven a liar. As Jadon was going back again toward Jerusalem, a lion met him, dragged him down from his beast, and killed him, but did no harm at all to the donkey. Instead, it sat beside it and guarded both it and the prophet's body, until some travelers, seeing this, came into the city and reported it to the false prophet. He sent his sons and had the body brought into the city, and gave it a costly funeral, charging his sons that when he himself died, he too should be buried with him, saying that everything the man had prophesied against that city and its altar and its priests and its false prophets was true, and that he himself would be dishonored after his death by not being buried with him, since his bones would not be recognizable. Having buried the prophet and given these instructions to his sons, wicked and impious as he was, he went to Jeroboam and said, "Why ever were you so troubled by the words of that fool?" And when the king recounted to him the events at the altar and concerning his own hand, calling the man a true prophet indeed and the best of prophets, the old man began to undermine this opinion of his, working mischief and using plausible arguments about what had happened to damage the truth of it. For he tried to persuade him that his hand had gone numb from the effort of carrying the sacrifices, and had afterward, once relieved, returned again to its natural state, and that the altar, being new and having received many great sacrifices, had split and collapsed under the weight of what had been piled upon it. He went on explaining. He also told him how the man who had foretold these signs had died, killed by a lion, so utterly did he retain not one word of the prophet, nor speak one. By saying this, he persuaded the king, turning his mind completely away from God and from holy and righteous deeds, and drove him on to impious actions. And Jeroboam grew so insolent toward the divine and so lawless that he sought nothing else, day after day, but what new and more depraved thing he might dare beyond what he had already ventured. Let this much said about Jeroboam suffice for the present. Rehoboam, the son of Solomon and king of the two tribes, as we have said before, built strong and large cities: Bethlehem, Adam, Tekoa, Bethzer, Soko, Adullam, Ipan, Mersha, Ziph, Adorim, Lachish, Azka, Zora, Ajalon, and Hebron. These he built first in the tribal territory and allotment of Judah, and he also constructed other large ones in the allotment of Benjamin. He fortified them all with walls, stationed garrisons and commanders in each, and stored up in every city abundant grain, wine, and oil and everything else needed for provisioning, and besides these, shields and spears numbering many tens of thousands. The priests from among all the Israelites came together to him at Jerusalem, along with the Levites and any others of the people who were good and just, leaving their own cities behind so that they might worship God at Jerusalem. For they were unwilling to bow, under compulsion, to the calves that Jeroboam had made. And they strengthened Rehoboam's kingdom for 3 years. He married a kinswoman and had 3 children by her, and later took as well Maacah, daughter of Absalom's daughter Tamar, who was also his kinswoman. And a male child was born to him from her, whom he named Abijah. He fathered children by several other women besides, but of them all he loved Maacah the most. He had 18 wives joined to him by law and 30 concubines, and he had 28 sons and 60 daughters born to him. He named Abijah, the son of Maacah, as successor to the kingdom, and entrusted to him the treasures and the strongest cities. I think it is often the case that greatness of circumstance, and the turn of affairs toward the better, becomes for men the cause of much wrongdoing and lawlessness. For seeing his kingdom grow in this way, Rehoboam turned aside to unjust and impious deeds and came to despise the worship of God, so that even the people under him became imitators of his transgressions. For the character of the ruled is corrupted along with the ways of their rulers, and, treating their own restraint as a rebuke to the licentiousness of their leaders, they follow their vices as though following virtue. For it is not possible to seem to approve the deeds of kings while not doing the same things oneself. This, then, is what happened also to those set under Rehoboam. While he was impious and lawless, they too made it their concern not to offend the king by wishing to be just. To punish him for these outrages, God sent against him Isocos, king of the Egyptians, about whose deeds Herodotus, misled, attributes them to Sesostris. This Isocos, in the 5th year of Rehoboam's reign, marched against him with many tens of thousands of men. 1,200 chariots followed him, 60,000 cavalry, and 400,000 infantry. Most of these he brought from the Libyans and the Ethiopians. He invaded the land of the Hebrews, seized the strongest cities of Rehoboam's kingdom without a fight, and having secured them, at last came against Jerusalem itself, where Rehoboam and the people were shut in because of Isocos's campaign, imploring God to grant them victory and deliverance. But they did not persuade God to take his stand with them. Rather, the prophet Shemaiah told them that God threatened to abandon them, just as they themselves had abandoned his worship. On hearing this, they immediately lost heart, and seeing no further hope of deliverance, all of them hastened to confess, admitting that God would rightly overlook them, since they had become impious toward him and had confounded his laws. But when God saw them in this state, acknowledging their sins, he told the prophet that he would not destroy them, but would nonetheless make them subject to the Egyptians, so that they might learn which is less burdensome, to serve a man or to serve God. Isocos took the city without a fight, since Rehoboam surrendered it out of fear, but he did not abide by the agreements that had been made. Instead, he plundered the temple, emptied out the treasures of God and of the king, carrying off countless tens of thousands in gold and silver, and leaving nothing at all behind. He also took away the golden shields and the shields that King Solomon had made, nor did he leave the golden quivers that David had dedicated to God, which he had taken from the king of Sophene. Having done this, he returned to his own country. Herodotus of Halicarnassus also mentions this campaign, mistaken only about the king's name, and says that he marched against many other nations as well and enslaved Palestinian Syria, taking the people in it without a fight. It is clear that he means to indicate our own nation as having been subdued by the Egyptian, for he adds that the king left steely in the land of those who surrendered to him without a fight, on which he inscribed the private parts of women, and it was our king who surrendered the city to him without a fight. He says, too, that the Ethiopians learned circumcision of the private parts from the Egyptians, for the Phoenicians and the Syrians of Palestine themselves admit that they learned it from the Egyptians. It is plain, then, that no others among the Syrians of Palestine are circumcised except ourselves alone. But on these matters let each say what seems right to him. When Isocos had withdrawn, King Rehoboam had bronze shields made, equal in number, to replace the golden shields, and gave them into the keeping of the guards of the palace. And instead of living with the fame of great generalship and the splendor of great affairs, he reigned the rest of his time in great quiet and fear, remaining always an enemy of Jeroboam. He died at the age of 57, having reigned 17 years, a boastful and foolish man by character, who lost much of his power through failing to heed his father's friends. He was buried at Jerusalem in the tombs of the kings. His son Abijah succeeded him to the kingdom in the 18th year of Jeroboam's reign over the 10 tribes. Such, then, was the end of these matters. As for Jeroboam, we must now relate what followed and how he ended his life. For he did not cease or relent in his insolence toward God, but continued, day after day, setting up altars on the high mountains and appointing priests from among the common people. These impious acts, along with the punishment due for them, were not long in turning back upon his own head and upon the head of his whole family at the hand of the divine. At that time, when his son, whom they called Abijah, fell ill, he ordered his wife to lay aside her royal dress, take on the appearance of a private person, and go to the prophet Ahijah, for he was a remarkable man in foretelling what was to come, and indeed had foretold to him his kingship. When she arrived, he told her to inquire about the boy, as though a stranger, whether he would recover from his illness. She, disguised as her husband had instructed her, came to the city of Shiloh, for that is where Ahijah was living. And as she was about to enter his house, his eyes dimmed by old age, God appeared to him and revealed both things, that Jeroboam's wife had come to him, and what he ought to answer regarding the matter she had come about. As the woman entered the house appearing to be a private person and a stranger, he cried out, "Come in, wife of Jeroboam, why do you hide yourself? You do not escape God's notice. He has told me you would arrive and instructed me what words I am to speak. Go then to your husband and tell him this. Since I raised you up from small and insignificant beginnings, and, tearing the kingdom away from the house of David, gave it to you, and you have forgotten these things, and, abandoning my worship, have made molten gods and honor them instead, so I will bring you down again and destroy your whole family utterly, and make it food for dogs and birds. For a king shall be raised up by me from all the people, who will leave no one of Jeroboam's family remaining. The people, too, will share in the punishment, cast out of the good land and scattered into the regions beyond the Euphrates, because they followed the impieties of their king and worshiped the gods he made, abandoning my sacrifice. And you, woman, hasten to your husband bearing this news. As for your son, you will find him already dead, for as you enter the city his life will leave him. He will be mourned and buried by all the people, honored with a common grief, for he alone of Jeroboam's family was good." After he had prophesied these things, the woman rushed out in distress, deeply grieved at the death foretold for her son, mourning along the road and beating her breast over her child's coming end. Wretched in her suffering, she hurried on, helpless, eager, and yet unwilling because of her son, since she would sooner see him dead by hastening, yet compelled to hurry because of her husband. When she arrived, she found him already dead, just as the prophet had said, and reported everything to the king. Jeroboam, giving no thought to any of this, gathered a large army and marched out to make war on Abijah, the son of Rehoboam, who had succeeded his father as king of the two tribes, for he despised him on account of his youth. But Abijah, hearing of Jeroboam's advance against him, was not dismayed. Instead, rising above both his youth in spirit and his enemy's expectations, he chose an army from the two tribes and met Jeroboam at a place called Mount Zemaraim. He encamped near him and made his preparations for battle. His forces numbered 400,000. Jeroboam's army was twice that number. As the armies drew up against each other for the struggle and the danger, and were about to engage, Abijah stood on a high place and, gesturing with his hand toward the crowd, asked that Jeroboam too listen to him first in silence. When silence had fallen, he began to speak. "That God had granted the rule to David and his descendants for all time, you yourselves do not fail to know. But I am amazed how you, abandoning my father, attached yourselves to his servant Jeroboam, and are now present with him to make war on those whom God has judged fit to reign, and to take away the rule that rightly belongs to them, the greater part of which Jeroboam holds unjustly to this day. But I do not think he will enjoy even this much longer. Rather, once he has paid the penalty to God for the past as well, he will cease from the lawlessness and outrages which he has not stopped committing against him, and which he has persuaded you also to commit, you who suffered no wrong from my father. But because he did not speak to please the assembly, persuaded by the counsel of wicked men, you deserted him, seemingly out of anger. But in truth, you tore yourselves away from God and his laws. And yet, it would have been well for you to have made allowance, not merely for the harsh words of a young man inexperienced in leading the people, but even if his youth and inexperience in affairs had led him into some harsh act, for the sake of Solomon our father and his benefactions, for the good deeds of fathers ought to serve as a plea for the errors of their descendants. But you took none of this into account, either then or now, but have brought so great an army against us. In what then do you place your trust for victory? Is it in the golden calves and the altars on the mountains, which are proofs of your impiety, not of true worship? Or does your numbers make you confident, since your army outnumbers ours? But no strength of a numerous army fighting alongside injustice avails, for it is in justice alone, and in piety toward the divine, that the surest hope of prevailing over one's enemies rests. And that is ours, since we have kept the laws from the beginning and worship our own God, whom no hands have made out of perishable matter, nor the device of a wicked king contrived to deceive the crowds, but who is himself the maker and the beginning and the end of all things. I urge you then, even now, to change your minds, to take better counsel, to cease from making war, and to recognize the ancestral ways that raised you to so great a measure of prosperity. This is what Abijah said to the people. But while he was still speaking, Jeroboam secretly sent some of his soldiers to surround Abijah, coming from parts of the camp that were not visible. When Abijah found himself encircled in the midst of the enemy, his army was struck with fear and lost heart. But Abijah encouraged them and urged them to place their hopes in God. For he himself, he said, was not encircled by the enemy. Altogether, calling on God's aid, and at the sound of the priests' trumpets, they raised the war cry and advanced upon the enemy. And God shattered their enemies' resolve and broke their fighting strength, and made Abijah's army superior. So great a slaughter as had never before been recorded in war, whether among Greeks or barbarians, they were found worthy to inflict on Jeroboam's forces, winning a wondrous and celebrated victory from God. They cut down 500,000 of their enemies, and, taking their strongest cities by storm, plundered them, Bethel and its district, and Jeshanah and its district. And Jeroboam, after this, the defeat, for as long as Abijah lived. He died not long after enjoying this victory, having reigned 3 years, and was buried in Jerusalem in the tombs of his ancestors. He left behind 22 sons and 16 daughters, all born to him by 14 wives. His son Asa succeeded him to the kingdom. His mother's name, the young king's mother, was Maachah. During his reign, the land of the Israelites enjoyed peace for 10 years. This, then, is what we have received concerning Abijah son of Rehoboam son of Solomon. Jeroboam, king of the 10 tribes, also died, having ruled for 22 years, and his son Nadab succeeded him in the second year of Asa's reign. Jeroboam's son ruled for 2 years, resembling his father in impiety and wickedness. During these 2 years he campaigned against Gabbethon, a Philistine city, and settled down to take it by siege. But while there he was plotted against by a friend of his named Baasha, son of Ahijah, and was killed. After his death, Baasha took the kingdom and destroyed the entire house of Jeroboam. And it came to pass, in accordance with God's prophecy, that those of Jeroboam's kin who died in the city were torn apart and devoured by dogs, and those who died in the fields by birds. Thus the house of Jeroboam paid the penalty its impiety and lawless deeds deserved. Asa, king of Jerusalem, was a man of excellent character, who looked to God and neither did nor thought anything that did not bear on piety and the keeping of the laws. He set his kingdom in order, cutting out whatever wickedness was in it and purging it of every stain. His army of picked men, armed with shield and spear, numbered 300,000 from the tribe of Judah, and from the tribe of Benjamin 250,000 men bearing shields and skilled with the bow. When he had already reigned 10 years, Zerah, king of Ethiopia, marched against him with a great force, 900,000 infantry, 10,000 cavalry, and 300 chariots. He advanced as far as the city of Mersha, which belongs to the tribe of Judah, and Asa went out to meet him with his own forces, arraying his army against him in a certain ravine called Zephatha, not far from the city. When he saw the multitude of the Ethiopians, Asa cried aloud and asked victory of God, and asked to capture the enemy's many thousands, for he said he trusted in nothing else but God's help, which was able to make even the few stronger than the many, and the weak stronger than the powerful, to face Zerah in battle. As Asa was saying this, God signaled victory, and Asa joined battle, and with the joy of those to whom God had foretold it, he killed many of the Ethiopians and pursued those who turned to flight as far as the region of Gerar. Abandoning the slaughter, they turned to plundering the cities, for Gerar itself was captured, and went on to plunder the enemy's camp as well. They carried off a great quantity of gold and a great quantity of silver, and drove away as plunder camels and pack animals and herds of cattle. Asa and the army with him, having received such a victory and such spoils from God, returned to Jerusalem. As they arrived, a prophet named Azariah met them on the road. He bade them halt their march and began to speak to them, saying that they had obtained this victory from God because they had shown themselves just and holy and had done everything according to God's will. He said that if they persevered, God would always grant them mastery over their enemies and a life of happiness, but if they abandoned true worship, all the opposite of this would befall them. And a time would come in which no true prophet would be found among their multitude, nor any priest declaring what was right, but their cities would be laid waste, and the nations scattered over every land, to live a wandering, homeless life. He counseled them, while they still had the opportunity to be good, and not to squander God's goodwill toward them. Hearing this, the king and the people rejoiced and took great care, both together and each on his own, for what was just. The king also sent men out into the countryside to see to the observance of the laws. This is what happened in the reign of Asa, king of the two tribes. I now return to the multitude of the Israelites and to their king Baasha, who had killed Nadab son of Jeroboam and seized the throne. For this man, residing in the city of Tirzah and making it his residence, reigned 24 years, and having become more wicked and impious than even Jeroboam and his son, he did much harm to the people and insulted God greatly. God sent the prophet Jehu to him to foretell that he would destroy his entire family and would ruin his house with the same evils with which he had afflicted the house of Jeroboam, because, having been made king by him, he had not repaid the benefit by leading the people justly and piously, which would have been good first for them, being such as they were, and then pleasing to God, but instead had imitated the wicked Jeroboam, and though that man's soul had already perished, had shown that his own wickedness was very much alive. He said Baasha would therefore reasonably suffer a fate like the one that had befallen him, since he had made himself like him. Baasha, having heard beforehand what evils would befall him and his whole family because of what he had dared, did not thereafter grow quiet, so as not to die reputed even more wicked, and repenting at least of what was past, obtain forgiveness. Instead, like men who, once they have set their hearts on a prize before them, never cease striving for it, so Baasha too, though the prophet had foretold what was coming as the greatest of evils, the destruction of his family and the ruin of his house, grew worse, and day by day added, like an athlete of wickedness, further labors to that pursuit. Finally, he took his army once again and attacked a city of some renown named Ramah, 40 stadia from Jerusalem, and, seizing it, began to fortify it, having already resolved to leave a garrison there, so that setting out from it, they might do harm to Asa's kingdom. Asa, fearing this enemy undertaking and reckoning that the force left at Ramah would do much harm to the whole kingdom under him, sent envoys to the king of Damascus, along with gold and silver, asking for an alliance and reminding him that there was also a friendship between their fathers. The king gladly accepted the great sum of money and made an alliance with him, dissolving his friendship with Baasha, and sending the commanders of his own forces to the cities under Baasha's rule, ordered them to do them harm. They went and burned some and plundered others, including the cities called Ijon and Dan and Abel Bethmaka, and many others. Hearing this, the king of the Israelites stopped building and fortifying Ramah and hastened back to help his own people, who were suffering harm. Asa, using the material that had been prepared for the building, erected two strong cities on that very site, one called Jebba, the other Mizpah. After this, Baasha found no opportunity to campaign against Asa, for he was overtaken by fate and was buried in the city of Tirzah, and his son Allah took over the rule. He ruled for 2 years and died, murdered through the treachery of Zimri, the commander of half his cavalry. While Allah was feasting at the house of his steward, a man named Arza, Zimri persuaded some of the horsemen under his own command to rush upon him and, through them, killed him while he was isolated from the soldiers and officers around him. For all of these were occupied with the siege of Gabbethon, the Philistine city. Having killed Allah, Zimri, the cavalry commander, made himself king and destroyed the entire family of Baasha, in accordance with Jehu's prophecy. For it happened that his house perished root and branch for its impiety, in the same manner as we have written that Jeroboam's house was destroyed. But the army besieging Gabbethon, learning what had happened to the king and that Zimri had killed him and taken the kingdom, made their own commander, Omri, king instead, and he, rousing the army from Gabbethon, came to Tirzah, the royal seat, and attacking the city by force, took it. Zimri, seeing the city taken, fled to the innermost part of the palace, and setting it on fire, burned himself alive together with it, having reigned 7 days. The people of Israel immediately split, some wishing Tibni to be king, others Omri. Those who favored Omri prevailed and killed Tibni, and Omri became king over the whole people. In the 30th year of Asa's reign, Omri began to rule for 12 years, 6 of these in the city of Tirzah, the rest in the city called Samaron, which the Greeks call Samaria. He himself named it Samoraeus, after the man who sold him the hill on which he built the city, Samaros. He differed in no way from the kings before him except in being worse than they were, for all of them sought ways to turn the people away from God through their daily impieties, and for this reason God brought it about that they destroyed one another, leaving no one of their line. He too died in Samaria, and his son Ahab succeeded him. From these events, one can learn how great a concern the divine has for human affairs, and how it loves the good, but hates the wicked, and destroys them root and branch. For the kings of the Israelites, one after another, because of their lawlessness and injustices, were in a short time seen to perish wretchedly along with their families. Whereas Asa, king of Jerusalem and the two tribes, on account of his piety and righteousness, was brought by God to a long and happy old age and died fortunate, having reigned 41 years. When he died, his son Jehoshaphat, born to him by a wife named Abida, succeeded to the rule. Everyone judged him, in his deeds, to be an imitator of David his great-grandfather in both courage and piety. But it is not yet urgent to speak of this king. Ahab, king of the Israelites, lived in Samaria and held the throne for 22 years, introducing nothing new from the kings before him, except that, through the extremity of his wickedness, he devised things for the worse, imitating all their crimes and their insolence toward the divine, and above all zealously following the lawlessness of Jeroboam. For he too worshipped the calves that Jeroboam had made, and in addition contrived other strange things. He married a wife, the daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Tyrians and Sidonians, named Jezebel, from whom he learned to worship her own gods. This woman was forceful and bold, and fell into such wantonness and madness that she even built a temple to the god of the Tyrians whom they call Belos, and planted a grove of all kinds of trees. She also appointed priests and false prophets to this god, and the king himself kept many such men about him, having surpassed in folly and wickedness all who came before him. A prophet of the great God, from the city of Tishb in the region of Gilead, came to Ahab and declared that God foretold he would send neither rain upon him in those years nor dew upon the land, unless he himself appeared. Having sworn to this, he withdrew to the regions toward the south, making his dwelling by a certain stream, from which he also had his drink, for ravens brought him food each day. When the stream dried up for lack of rain, he went, at God's command, to the city of Zarephath, not far from Sidon and Tyre, for it lies between them, for he would find there a widow woman who would provide him with food. Not far from the gate he saw a poor woman gathering sticks, and when God made clear that she was the one who was to sustain him, he approached, greeted her, and asked her to bring him water to drink. And as she went, he called her back and told her also to bring him bread. When she swore that she had nothing but a single handful of flour and a little oil, and was going to gather the sticks in order to knead it and make bread for herself and her child, after which, she said, having spent what little there was, they would die of hunger with nothing left, he told her, "Take courage, go and expect better things, and first make a small portion and bring it to me. For I tell you in advance that that jar of flour will never fail, nor the jug of oil, until God sends rain." When the prophet had said this, she went to her house and did as he had told her, and she herself had food, and provided sustenance for her child and for the prophet, and nothing of these ran short for them, until the drought too came to an end. Menander also mentions this drought in his history of the deeds of Ethbal, king of the Tyrians, saying as follows: "There was a drought in his reign from the month of Hyperbarateos until the Hyperbarateos of the following year, and when he made supplication, sufficient thunderbolts fell. This man founded the city of Batres in Phoenicia and Azza in Libya." And in recording these things, Menander was describing the drought that occurred in the time of Ahab. For in his time, Ethbal too was king of the Tyrians, as Menander has written. Now the woman of whom we spoke before, the one who sustained the prophet when her child fell ill, so gravely that he gave up his spirit and seemed dead, wept aloud, tearing at herself with her hands, and uttering such cries as her suffering dictated, blamed his presence, since he had exposed her sins and her son had died for that reason. Elijah told her to take courage and hand the boy over to him, for he would restore him alive. She gave him up, and Elijah carried him to the upper room where he himself was staying, laid him on the bed, and cried out to God that it was not right to repay so badly the woman who had taken him in and fed him by taking away her son. He begged God to send the soul back into the child and grant him life. God took pity on the mother and wished also to do the prophet the favor of not letting it seem that his presence with her had brought her harm, and against all expectation, the boy came back to life. The woman thanked the prophet and said she now knew for certain that the divine spoke with him. A little time later, by God's will, Elijah went to King Ahab to tell him that rain was coming. Famine held the whole country in its grip at that time, and there was such a severe shortage of necessities that not only were people going without, but the land no longer produced even enough for the horses and other livestock to graze on, because of the drought. So the king summoned the man in charge of his property, Obadiah, and told him he wished to go out to the springs of water and the streams, so that if grass could be found anywhere near them, they might cut it and have feed for the animals. And he sent men throughout the whole inhabited world to search for the prophet Elijah, but they had not found him. He ordered Obadiah to go with him as well. They decided to set out, and dividing the roads between them, Obadiah and the king each went a different way. Now it happened that at the time when Queen Jezebel was killing the prophets, this same Obadiah had hidden 100 of them in the caves beneath Garris and had kept them fed, supplying them only with bread and water. While Obadiah was alone, separated from the king, the prophet Elijah met him. Elijah asked who he was, and when he learned, Obadiah bowed down to him. Elijah told him to go to the king and say that he was present before him. But Obadiah said, what wrong had he suffered at Elijah's hands that he should be sent to a man seeking to kill him, one who had searched every land for him? Or did Elijah not know that Ahab had left no place he had not sent men to fetch him from, if they should catch him, to put him to death? He said he was afraid on his own account that once God had appeared to him, Elijah might again go off to some other place. And then, after the king had sent for him and failed to find him, wherever on earth he might be, he himself would die for missing him. He therefore begged Elijah to look after his safety by considering the loyalty he had shown toward his fellow prophets, saying that he had saved 100 prophets when Jezebel had destroyed all the rest, and that he was keeping them hidden and feeding them. Elijah told him to go to the king without any fear at all, and gave him a sworn pledge that he would certainly appear before Ahab that very day. When Obadiah had reported to the king that Elijah was there, Ahab went to meet him and asked him angrily whether he was the one who had brought harm on the Hebrew people and was responsible for the barrenness of the land. Elijah, without flattering him at all, said that Ahab himself had done all the terrible things, since his family had brought foreign gods into the country and worshipped them, and had abandoned their own God, who alone is God, and no longer gave him any thought at all. He then told Ahab to go up and gather the whole people to Mount Carmel, along with his own prophets and those of his wife, stating how many there were, together with the prophets of the sacred groves, who numbered about 400. When Ahab had sent word around and all had assembled on the mountain named above, the prophet Elijah stood among them and asked how long they meant to go on living like this, divided in mind and in belief. If they thought the God of their own country was the true and only God, he urged them to follow him and his commandments. But if they thought nothing of him and supposed instead that they ought to worship the foreign gods, he advised them to follow those. When the crowd made no answer to this, Elijah, since he alone was a prophet of his God, while the others had 400, asked to put to the test the power of the foreign gods against that of his own. He proposed that he himself take a bull, sacrifice it, and lay it on wood without lighting the fire, and that the others do the same and then call on their own gods to kindle the wood. For once this was done, they would learn the true nature of God. The plan pleased them, and Elijah told the prophets to choose a bull and sacrifice it first, and to call on their own gods. But when nothing came of their prayer and invocation as they made their sacrifice, Elijah mocked them and told them to call on their gods with a loud shout, for surely they were away on a journey or asleep. They kept at this from early morning until midday, cutting themselves with knives and lances according to their ancestral custom. When Elijah was about to perform his own sacrifice, he told some of the people to withdraw and others to come close and watch him, so that he would not secretly throw fire onto the wood. When the crowd had come near, he took 12 stones, one for each tribe of the Hebrew people, and built an altar from them, and dug a very deep trench around it. He arranged the split wood on the altar, laid the victims on top of it, and ordered 4 jars of water to be poured from the spring over the altar, until it overflowed, and the whole trench was filled with water drawn from the spring. Having done this, he began to pray to God and call on him, asking him to make his power manifest to a people who had already gone astray for so long. And as he was still speaking, suddenly, while the crowd watched, fire fell from heaven onto the altar and consumed the sacrifice, so that even the water was burned up and the ground turned to dust. When the Israelites saw this, they fell to the ground and worshipped, calling on the one, greatest, and true God alone, and denouncing the others as names invented by a base and foolish opinion. They seized the prophets of those gods, and at Elijah's urging, put them to death. Elijah told the king to go and eat with no further worry, for in a little while he would see God send rain. So Ahab went off, and Elijah climbed to the summit of Mount Carmel, sat on the ground, and rested his head on his knees, and told his servant to go up to a certain lookout point and watch the sea, and if he saw a cloud rising anywhere, to tell him, for until then the air had remained clear. The servant went up and reported repeatedly that he saw nothing, but on the 7th time he went, he said he had seen something darkening the air, no larger than a human footprint. When Elijah heard this, he sent word to Ahab telling him to go down to the city before the rain broke. Ahab set out for the city of Jezreel, and soon afterward the sky grew dark, was covered with clouds, a violent wind arose, and a heavy rain fell. The prophet, seized by the God, ran alongside the king's chariot all the way to the city of Jezreel. When Ahab's wife Jezebel learned of the signs Elijah had performed, and that he had killed their prophets, she was enraged and sent messengers to him, threatening to have him killed in return for his destroying her prophets. Elijah, afraid, fled to a city called Beersheba, which lies at the farthest edge of the territory held by the tribe of Judah, bordering the land of Idumea. There he left his servant and withdrew into the desert, praying to die, for he said he was no better than his forefathers, that he should wish to go on living after they had perished. He lay down to sleep beside a tree, and when someone woke him, he rose and found food and water set beside him. He ate, and drawing strength from that food, he traveled to the mountain called Sinai, where Moses is said to have received the laws from God. Finding a hollow cave there, he went in and continued to make his dwelling in it. A voice came to him from somewhere unseen, asking why he had left the city and come there, when he had killed the prophets of the foreign gods and persuaded the people that the one who is the only God, the one they had worshipped from the beginning. Elijah said that for this, the king's wife was seeking to punish him. He then heard the voice tell him to go out again the next day into the open air, for there he would learn what he must do. He went out of the cave in daylight, heard an earthquake, and saw a bright flash of fire. When quiet had settled, a divine voice bid him not to be troubled by what had happened, for none of his enemies would overpower him, and it commanded him, on his return home, to appoint Jehu son of Nimshi as king over the people, and Hazael as king of the Syrians in Damascus. In his own place, it said, Elisha of the city of Abel-Mehalah would become prophet in his stead. Of the impious multitude, Hazael would destroy some and Jehu the rest. Hearing this, Elijah turned back to the land of the Hebrews and found Elisha, son of Shaphat, plowing, with some others alongside him driving 12 yoke of oxen. He went up to him and threw his own cloak over him. Elisha at once began to prophesy, and leaving the oxen, followed Elijah. He asked leave to embrace his parents before going, and when Elijah told him to do so, he took leave of them and followed him, remaining Elijah's disciple and attendant for the rest of his life. So much, then, for this prophet. Now a certain Naboth, from the city of Jezreel, was the neighboring landowner of the king. Ahab urged him to sell, for whatever price he wished, the field of his that lay next to the king's own, so that by joining it he might make it a single estate. And if Naboth did not wish to take money, Ahab offered to let him choose any of his own fields in exchange. Naboth said he would do neither, and that he would keep and enjoy the very land he had inherited from his father. Ahab, distressed as though insulted by his failure to take what belonged to another, would neither bathe nor eat. When his wife Jezebel asked why he was distressed and would neither bathe nor take his lunch or dinner, he told her of Naboth's stubbornness, and how, after addressing him with reasonable words even more modest than his royal authority required, he had been insulted by not getting what he asked for. She urged him not to be so small-minded over this, and to set his grief aside and turn again to his usual care for his body, for she would see to Naboth's punishment herself. At once she sent letters in Ahab's name to the leading men among the Israelites, ordering them to proclaim a fast, and, having called an assembly, to seat Naboth in front, since he was of distinguished family, and to have three bold men ready to bear false witness against him, claiming he had blasphemed both God and the king, and then to stone him and finish him off in this way. And so Naboth, just as the queen had written, was falsely accused of blaspheming God and Ahab, and was stoned to death by the crowd. When Jezebel heard of this, she went in to the king and told him to take possession of Naboth's vineyard without payment. Ahab was delighted at what had happened, and leaping up from his bed, went off to see Naboth's vineyard. But God, angered, sent the prophet Elijah to the plot of Naboth's land to confront Ahab and ask him about what he had done, since he had killed the true owner of the land and had unjustly taken possession of it himself. When Elijah came to him, the king asked what he intended to do with him, for it was shameful for him to be caught in wrongdoing by Elijah. Elijah replied that in that very place where Naboth's corpse had been devoured by dogs, his own blood and his wife's would be shed, and his whole family would perish, for daring such impiety and, against their ancestral laws, unjustly killing a citizen. Grief and remorse for what he had done came over Ahab, and putting on sackcloth he went about barefoot, taking no food, confessing his sins, and in this way trying to appease God. God told the prophet that he would put off the punishment of Ahab's family while Ahab himself lived, in view of his repentance for what he had dared to do, but that he would carry out the threat upon Ahab's son. And the prophet made this known to the king. While matters stood thus with Ahab, at the same time the king of the Syrians and of Damascus, son of Hadad, gathered a force from the whole of his country, made allies of 32 kings from beyond the Euphrates, and marched against Ahab. Ahab, whose army was no match for his, did not draw up his forces for battle, but shut everything in the country away in the strongest cities, while he himself remained in Samaria, for that city was surrounded by very strong walls and seemed otherwise hard to capture. The Syrian king brought up his forces against Samaria, surrounded it with his army, and laid siege to it. He sent a herald to Ahab asking him to receive envoys from him, through whom he would make known what he wanted. The king of the Israelites having granted permission for them to come, the envoys arrived and said, on the king's instructions, that Ahab's wealth, his children, and his wives belonged to Ben-Hadad. But if Ahab agreed and let him take from these whatever he wished, Ben-Hadad would withdraw his army and stop the siege. Ahab ordered the envoys to go and tell their king that both he himself and all that was his belonged to Ben-Hadad. When they reported this back, Ben-Hadad sent to him again, demanding that, since Ahab had already agreed that everything was his, he should now receive the men Ben-Hadad would send the next day, whom he would order to search the palace and the houses of Ahab's friends and relatives, and to take whatever they found, whatever finest thing they find among them, and leave you whatever displeases you. Ahab, astonished at this second embassy from the king of the Syrians, called the people together in an assembly, and told them that he himself had been ready, for the sake of his own safety, and for peace, to give up his wives and children to the enemy, and to yield all his possessions. For that was what the Syrian had first demanded in his embassy. But now he has seen fit to send his own slaves to search all our houses, and to leave nothing in them of our finest property, seeking a pretext for war, since he knows that I would not spare what is my own for your sakes, and is contriving, out of his displeasure over what belongs to you, an occasion for making war. Still, I will do whatever seems best to you. The people said there was no need even to listen to his demands, but that they should treat him with contempt and stand ready for war. Ahab therefore answered the ambassadors and told them, as they left, that he still stood by what he had first agreed to grant for the sake of his citizens' safety, but that he would not submit to the second demand, and so he sent them away. Ben-Hadad, hearing this and taking it hard, sent envoys to Ahab a third time, threatening to raise a siege mound higher than the walls he so despised, using his army, gathering a mere handful of earth from each man, to display to Ahab the size of his forces and to strike terror into him. When Ahab answered that a man should not boast while he was still putting on his armor, but only once he had proved himself the better in battle, the envoys came and found the king at dinner with 32 allied kings and reported his answer to him. Ben-Hadad at once gave the order both to build a rampart around the city and to throw up siege mounds and to leave out no method of blockade. While these things were being done, Ahab was in terrible anguish, together with all his people. But he took courage and was freed from his fears when a certain prophet came to him and told him that God promised to make so many tens of thousands of the enemy subject to his hand. When Ahab asked through whom the victory would come, the prophet said, "Through the sons of the commanders, with Ahab himself leading them, because of the enemy's inexperience in dealing with them." Ahab called together the sons of the commanders, and about 232 were found. Learning that the Syrian had given himself over to feasting and ease, Ahab opened the gates and sent the young men out. When the watchman reported this to Ben-Hadad, he sent some men to meet them, instructing them, if they had come out for battle, to bind them and bring them to him, but if peaceably, to do the same. Ahab, meanwhile, kept the rest of his army ready within the walls. The sons of the commanders engaged the guards, killed many of them, and pursued the rest all the way to the camp. Seeing them winning, the king sent out the whole of his remaining army as well. Falling on the Syrians without warning, it overpowered them, for they had not expected an attack and so met it half-armed and drunk, so that they fled and abandoned their weapons in the camps, and the king himself barely escaped, making his flight on horseback. Ahab pursued the Syrians a great distance, killing them as he went, and after plundering the camp, and the wealth was not small, but a great quantity of gold and silver, he took Ben-Hadad's chariots and horses and returned to the city. When the prophet told him to prepare himself and keep his forces ready, since the Syrian would march against him again the following year, Ahab attended to these preparations. Ben-Hadad, having escaped the battle with as much of his army as he could save, took counsel with his friends on how he might again make war on the Israelites. They advised against engaging them in the mountains, for their God, they said, had power in such places, and that was why they had now been defeated by them. But they said they would prevail if they made the battle on a plain.